you know, in the 21st century, everything we're going to do is going to be joint, and it's going to be multinational. I mean, that's the nature of where we've gone.
An army training in Australia highlights the military's changing mission. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, July 10th. Good evening, I'm Ann Hillman. Also tonight, after an environmental disaster, a BC mine gets approval to reopen.
We can't count on the BC environmental process to even follow their own recommendations.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This week, U.S. Army Alaska troops based at J-Bear have been taking part in a massive training exercise stretching from Alaska to Australia. Exercise Talisman Saber involves over 33,000 military personnel from three continents. The airborne unit playing lead in one of the several ongoing exercises in the Pacific Theater is slated for cutbacks. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the unit also exemplifies the Army's changing global mission.
It's hard to grasp the scale of Talisman Saber, an operation with months of planning designed around day-long rides inside massive cargo planes shuttling troops across the globe. Major Kim Edgard is one of about 500 airborne soldiers from the 425th Combat Brigade parachuting into a remote training site on the eastern edge of Australia.
It feels like jumping off the bed of a truck with your eyes closed.
We're on one of seven planes taking part in just one piece of the multinational exercise, which has happened every 2 years since 2005 to bolster relationships between the U.S. military and its partners in the Pacific, specifically Australia. The goal is dropping an instant fighting force on the other side of the world within 24 hours. And while it's a drill, it feels extremely realistic watching dozens of soldiers check and recheck 100-pound piles of equipment in the hours before they jump off the plane. Staff Sergeant Thomas Gutierrez is a jump master. It's his job to check chutes, get jumpers prepped, and keep them as safe as circumstances allow.
You have to be strong-willed because, again, your confidence and your attitude reflects the confidence of the jumper. And the more direct and more louder you are, the more confidence the jumpers will have in you, knowing that everything will go right.
It's a pretty short ride down. Jumpers exit at just 1,000 feet from the ground, a distance that's close enough to make out individual tree trunks through the open side doors. Today, there are just 5 injuries, well below the 2-4% casualty rate that Gutierrez and others expect on this kind of exercise.
This is one of the most safest things you can do if done properly. Everything is done in a repetitive motion over and over again to where it becomes second nature to us. But the smallest mistake could be catastrophic, like life-threatening.
After the first few dozen jumpers vanish out into the sun and wind, the plane makes another pass over the landing zone. Specialist Jordan Dunn is on deck, sitting under his giant rucksack with a machine gun fastened to his hip. He says he's not nervous, just eager to get out of the plane after so many long hours.
It's probably the best feeling in the world in the air when you let go of everything.
Once done and the last few jumpers land, they join a mock battle down below. The long, complicated, dangerous exercise begs the question, why do any of this at all? Even on a good day, there are injuries, the worst being a broken femur requiring helicopter transport. It's also expensive, with a price tag of $23 million for costs like fuel, thousands of field rations, and $200 disposable parachutes for dropping over a ton of blank ammo and medical equipment into the mock landing zone. Given a shrinking military and diminishing federal budgets, why bother?
I think a big part of it is it's just the capability. You know, it's a deterrent to our adversaries, but it's also reassurance to our allies.
Lieutenant Colonel Matt Hardman is in charge of the battalion taking lead on the airborne piece of Talisman Saber. We talk in the field his troops seized hours earlier, surrounded now by hundreds of sleeping bags, soldiers bedded down for the night. Airborne operations have been uncommon in the decades since World War II, although there have been a handful of publicly acknowledged small-scale drops in Iraq, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. But the capability is far from a staple in the U.S.'s contemporary arsenal. Hardman says maintaining the capacity to pull off airborne missions takes practice runs, which doubly serve to build relationships with military allies.
You know, in the 21st century, everything we're going to do is going to be joint, and it's going to be multinational. I mean, that's the nature of where we've gone. You know, all of the work that goes into it, into this exercise, is exactly kind of what I'd seen in my 4 deployments in Afghanistan and Iraq as well.
That spirit of camaraderie and cooperation is on full display by morning. In between quick bursts of rain, intermittent rainbows, and the occasional kangaroo sighting in the distance, the Australian and American troops lined up for a wing exchange ceremony, presided over by Lieutenant Colonel Jeff Crapo.
All right, hey men, when one nation of paratroopers jumps with another nation of paratroopers, they exchange their wings. You know, when you exit that aircraft, it takes a special individual to turn and face the door and jump out of that thing. And today we share that with our Australian brethren.
After the exercise finished and soldiers were ferried back to Amberley Air Force Base, an hour south towards Brisbane, troops started seeing news on their cell phones that this airborne unit stands to take one of the largest cuts of any brigade in the Army as part of a nationwide drawdown. By the time 425 is scaled back, they'll be a third of their current size, but still have the numbers and know-how to run the next iteration of Talisman Sabre in 2017. In Brisbane, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
A British Columbia mine that's become a symbol of mineral extraction's environmental threats will reopen next month. Provincial officials on Thursday granted the Mount Polley mine conditional approval to resume limited operations. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
The Central British Columbia Project's tailings dam broke about 10 months ago. That dumped more than 6 billion gallons of water and silt into nearby lakes and rivers. BC Mines Minister Bill Bennett says the new permit requires Mount Polley to put waste rock and water into a nearby abandoned mining pit.
The existing tailings storage facility, the one that breached last August, cannot be used, will not be used under the terms of this permit, and also means that there will be no water discharged off the mine site under the terms of this permit.
The mine will operate at half its earlier capacity to meet those standards. Mount Polley will have to gain additional government approval before releasing wastewater into the environment. Bennett says that would require additional water treatment equipment, and that would be expensive.
They will get that permit only if the water they propose to discharge, it meets Canadian drinking water guidelines, and also meets the standards for aquatic organisms.
The mine is owned by Vancouver-based Imperial Metals. Spokesman Steve Robertson did not immediately return a call for comment. The corporation has ignored similar calls over the past year. Mount Polley is in the watershed of the Fraser River, which enters the ocean far from Alaska. But critics in Southeast say the government's approach to the decision threatens the region's salmon, which spawn in other transboundary rivers. Guy Archibald works for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council.
We can't count on the BC environmental process to even follow their own recommendations to protect us from the mines that are proposed on the Stikine, Unik, and Taku rivers.
An independent report on the Mount Polley disaster predicted two similar British Columbia tailings dams would fail every decade. Archibald says that could include Imperial's Red Chris mine, which opened this year near a Stikine River tributary, and others.
Given that they're planning on putting 11 mines, you know, on the Alaska transboundary border, it's not if one of these dams is going to fail, it's only a matter of when.
British Columbia and Alaska officials met earlier this year on transboundary mining. BC's Bennett says they will meet again and could reach a memorandum of understanding regarding water and safety issues. Alaska officials have already submitted a list of concerns to BC, but they haven't actively opposed mine development. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, making a tiny traveling house a home.
We had the conversation of, you know, if we are living in this and this is our house, you know, we don't want to be sitting on milk crates with cushions on the top of them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Metlakatla on Annette Island has seen more visitors this year than ever before because of a new approach to cultural tourism. It may be the first time tourism pumps some noteworthy money into the Tsimshian community. KRBD's Ruth Eddy has more.
And we're going to be heading over to Metlakatla today to visit with the lovely Tsimshian people. My name is Ashley.
Boarding the tour boat from Thomas Basin in Ketchikan, cruise ship passengers are offered cushioned seats, each with a map and a pair of binoculars. The tour is called Cultural Treasures of Annette Island, and in its second year, it's still developing. A lot goes into planning a niche tour, what tourists will see and do, what snacks to offer, and what to call it.
The name is very important. You have to be very careful about the name you select. And the first one we had to tweak quite a bit, because the first one was Tsimshian Island, but people had trouble pronouncing Tsimshian and didn't know exactly what it meant anyway.
Amanda Painter is operations manager at Allen Marine Tours, which offers the day trip. She says Holland America suggested the name change. Metlakatla has seen cruising tourists before. Small cruise ship company Cruise West sent ships regularly, but the numbers dropped off in 2010 when Cruise West went out of business. Lacey Wilson is the Metlakatla Indian Community Director of Tourism. She began in 2009, and right away she got to work revamping and realigning the tour with the MIC's goals. The new tagline for the tourism department is culture, history, authenticity.
Highlighting our culture but not exploiting it in any way. And so cultural protection and integrity is something that we take very, very seriously.
The first major stop of the tour is the Duncan Cottage. The 124-year-old building served as the town's first clinic, pharmacy, library, and school.
In addition to all the functions that it served, it was also his home.
The first room on the left was William Duncan's bedroom. The Christian missionary who brought the first residents to Annette Island in 1887 is a major historical, but not cultural, figure.
Part of what Duncan did when he came here was he started integrating us into a more Anglican lifestyle. And he really honestly believed that was for our own good, so that we could prosper and live a better life. But that unfortunately meant a large amount of our culture at that time was lost.
For example, native language. In Duncan's home, now a museum, everything is labeled in both the English and Tsimshian languages, something Wilson says she's proud of and is the only curated collection she knows like it. Wilson says a lot of her job is working against preconceived notions.
There has always been a really unfortunate misconception, especially in Ketchikan, that you can't come here unless you have an invitation.
She says that is not true, and she hopes the growing tourism industry can show that the people of Metlakatla are hospitable and willing to share their lives. The highlight of the trip for most is the dance performance at the end. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Ruth Eddy.
A new documentary profiles the lives of the Tlingit veterans from Hoona who fought in the Vietnam War. As KTOO's Lisa Fu reports, Hunting in Wartime premieres in the Southeast Alaska Native Village tonight.
When I grew up, I wanted to be a hunter and a fisherman, and I could do both of them.
I don't think any of us said that we were going to be soldiers when we grew up.
When I was in Vietnam, I told myself, if I ever make it out of here, I'm going back home and I'm staying there until the day I die.
That's Donald C., Fred Bennett, and Victor Bean. They're three of the vets Brooklyn filmmaker Samantha Farinella interviewed for her documentary, Hunting in Wartime.
It's basically about the human cost of war and survivability in a community. It's also how you go through something and survive it and come out the other side. And thank goodness a lot of these guys did.
For some of the vets, her interviews released decades of bottled up emotion. As Ron Paul portrays in the film, many didn't talk about the war when they returned.
Everything you went through, now you hide it. And you're smiling on the outside, but you're cold inside.
Farinella says, in several ways, the Hoonah soldiers had a lot in common with the Vietnamese people they were fighting.
Almost every veteran I interviewed in the film says that they had a lot of respect for the Vietnamese people. They did feel close to them. It was a similar culture. One of the vets, Fred Bennett, said, like, they come from a small fishing village like I did. They're tight-knit with their families.
Farinella says the film explores Tlingit culture and their connection to the land. As hunters, the soldiers from Hoonah were used to taking life. But in war, it's different.
A good portion of the veterans I interviewed said that when they first had someone in their sights, they tried to think of them as a deer. But as George Lindoff said, I knew I was lying to myself.
When the men returned from war, many had terrible nightmares and experienced post-traumatic stress disorder. Some struggled with drugs and alcohol. Hunting in Wartime explores how, with the help of family and community, many of the vets climbed out of despair. Here's Warren Shakely.
My wife is tough. She slammed me up against the wall, almost knocked my lights out, and said, you talk about it. And I said, okay.
Farinella started the film in 2010. She visited the village several times, traveled to Juneau and as far away as Hawaii to interview about 20 vets from Hoonah. With the local friend and other connections, she built relationships in Hoonah with the veterans, their families, and the community.
You know, it took a village. Everybody was helping, and that felt good. You know, small things like the Hoonah Senior Center opened up so I can interview people in a quiet space. I was invited to play softball. It took a while. It was building trust.
Marlene Johnson was one of Farinella's local connections. Johnson was born and raised in Hoonah, and her nephew, Ronald Greenwald, fought and died in Vietnam. Johnson thinks most people in Hoonah are happy about the film.
And I think the veterans are, too, that somebody realizes they did something for their country. And, they're, you know, people that never been thanked for it, I think this, to them, is their thank you.
Hunting in Wartime has already started a conversation. After a screening of a rough cut last year, one vet's nephew said to Farinella, I never knew my uncle did that. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. APU is still accepting applications for fall 2015. Find out about financial aid and the promised tuition grant and apply online at alaskapacific.edu before Saturday, August 1st. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Ellen Lockyer. This week on AK, living tiny. A 1,200-square-foot house is considered small by today's standards, but one Juneau couple is leaving their home for something less than 100 square feet of livable space. They are hitting the road to follow their dreams, but that doesn't come without sacrifice. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more on going tiny to follow a dream.
On the curb in front of a brown house sits a bookshelf, a suitcase, and empty picture frames. Passersby might think the tenants are moving out or spring cleaning.
We don't really have enough time to do a true yard sale, so this is our like piecemeal, please everybody come take our stuff so we can move into 98 square feet.
There's also a sign to come knock on the door for more items for sale in the house. Kelly Towsley and her boyfriend, Curtis O'Rourke Stedman, are getting rid of nearly everything they own to fit into a tiny house on wheels parked outside their rental. From the outside, it looks like a glossy white travel trailer.
I mean, picture opening up the back of a U-Haul, and that's what we started with.
It looked rough when we first got it.
Come on up.
But the inside is more like a home.
So on the bottom here, we have four drawers.
With vinyl hardwood floors and lime green walls. They'll pull the trailer with a truck for a year-long road trip through the Alaska road system and down to the lower 48. For such a small space, it's remarkably plush. A bench folds out into a queen-sized bed.
We had the conversation of, you know, if we are living in this and this is our house, you know, we don't want to be sitting on milk crates with cushions on the top of them and, you know, feeling like we're going to get slivers in our fingers when we touch the walls.
Electricity runs off solar panels. There's a small bathroom separated by a curtain and a kitchenette, but no running water. It's Curtis and Kelly's version of the tiny house movement, downsizing and taking a DIY approach to home ownership. Many tiny houses are palaces compared to this trailer, but the couple needed something smaller and roadworthy. The cost was only $8,600. Curtis is a high school English teacher and musician. Last summer, he toured the interior for his solo project, Cousin Curtis.
So when I got back, I said, you know, this is it. I'm hitting the road. I want to do this full time. And Kelly was behind me 110% of the way.
Kelly remembers it differently. She thought he was talking about taking a vacation.
Whereas I think when the conversation happened, Curtis more so took it as, I'm hitting the road with him full time.
Yeah.
And I think it took a couple months of that conversation to happen, you know, where is it realistic for both of us to hit the road, you know, for both of us to quit our jobs?
Together, they decided it was. Kelly would quit her job working with autistic kids. They would sell everything and go on tour indefinitely, traveling from Toke to Chicken and down south through Montana and Michigan. Friends and family had mixed reactions, but no one said, this is a terrible idea. Don't do it.
No, I don't think anybody said that. I think a few people may have said, why would you do that? Like, they didn't understand it.
One of those people was Kelly's grandfather, a professional builder. They told him about their first big project.
Grandpa, we're going to cut in windows. We're going to install our own windows. And he said, well, you can't do that. You know, you can't install windows in a trailer. That doesn't make any sense. And so I sent he and my grandma the picture of us celebrating installing the first window. And he said, huh, they did it.
They completed the tiny house in 8 months. Then came time to purge all their stuff. For Curtis, the most difficult thing to give away was his plants, grown from the clippings of his great-great-grandmother's. Kelly says it was her clothes.
You know, I'll look at a shirt and be like, oh, I love that sweatshirt. Like, I wore that every home track meet in high school. But the reality is, I have those memories of track, and I don't need that sweatshirt, you know, to hold on to.
She says she's giving the tiny lifestyle a year. After that, she'll reassess.
Here and now, without you, but you're something to talk about.
Curtis wrote this song last summer about missing Kelly on tour. But now, he won't have to. The couple is setting off for miles of open road, pulling behind them what they'll call home.
I think it's awesome. I think it's a blessing to be able to ditch everything that you own and then take off in true nomad style, like, you know, humans used to be, and go hunter-gatherer across the country looking for adventure. Calling your name
in Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins. It
is here. This week, for 49 Voices, we're going far afield to hear from an Alaskan living in New Jersey. Michelle Spark grew up in Bethel, one of a set of triplets. Michelle and her two sisters run Arxotica, a line of skincare products made from botanicals they pick from the tundra. Michelle still feels very Alaskan, but these days she and her husband are raising their family in his home state. We asked how she keeps her Alaska Native culture alive for her two kids in Princeton, New Jersey.
Oh, it's very suburban. You know, there's a lot of the towns merge into each other, which is something I'm not used to being from Bethel, where our village is, you know, even though they're, you know, Oscarville's 10 minutes away, it's still usually a plane ride away or a boat ride away. So I'm not used to just merging seamlessly into new towns, but I do here in Jersey. Jokingly to my husband, you know, I'm like, I can't just have these white kids from New Jersey in my household. You know, we got to have our Alaskan and especially my Chupik culture identifiable. The house is, you know, loaded down with Alaska Native arts and crafts, and so I try to keep the identity very present. I do have seal oil in my freezer. I do have dry fish. I have fish strips. It doesn't mean so much to me when I bring it home and I'm eating it here in my New Jersey kitchen. It's a lot more meaningful when I eat it, you know, kind of fresh from home when I'm, you know, on location. I still kind of speak in imperatives in the Chupik language. You know, I'm just used to being bossed around in it. So I kind of do that with my kids too. And they know the words, they recognize them. You know, like achcha, which is, you know, be quiet, or asichduk, that's really good, you know, or inachji, go to bed, you know, that kind of thing. We do our best to bring them home, you know, for holidays or for the summer. And they're still young, they're only 6 and 10, but last summer they started helping us and they were just bouncing off the tundra. It was really adorable. And I thought, you know, I could get used to this, I could use their help, and you know, this is just really the best way for them to connect to their land, their homeland, is to be one with the earth and, you know, basically harvest from it.
Michelle Spark, originally from Bethel, lives in suburban New Jersey. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. If you want to tell your story, send an email to news@alaskapublic.org. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Elizabeth Jenkins, Liz Ruskin, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes in Australia, Ed Schoenfeld and Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Ruth Eddy in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Ann Hillman. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Garrison Keillor, one of the most beloved radio hosts and acclaimed humorists, is coming to the Alaska State Fair with his America the Beautiful tour on Sunday, August 30th at 3 p.m. This 2.5-hour show will feature Prairie Home Companion classics with piano master Richard Dworsky, sound effects man Fred Newman, and other special guests. Tickets at alaskastatefair.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.